The role of the Army in this kind of a program, Colonel?
In wartime, the primary mission of the military services is to prosecute the war against the enemy and to bring hostilities to a successful conclusion as soon as possible. I think it advisable to emphasize that our peacetime readiness, of which we are very proud, to lend assistance to civil authorities in disaster relief, cannot be counted upon in wartime because of the necessity to concentrate on our primary mission. But I think, Mr. Dreisky, you might be interested in some of the things that the military services can do. We will furnish you guidance as to which areas are most likely to be attacked. We will furnish you information as to anticipated form of attack. We will furnish you decisions on certain passive defense measures, for example, blackout, dimout, camouflage. We will warn you of a pending attack. And finally, we will render assistance where possible in the event of war-caused disasters upon request by proper authority, and again, I emphasize, where possible.
Well, Colonel, in that regard, one of the first things that the medical division did was to ask representatives of the Army and Navy and the U.S. Public Health Service and Red Cross to meet with us to see whether or not they could help us take care of an atomic, bacterial, or chemical attack on the city of Chicago. And we were told just exactly what you said. For example, the American Red Cross is set up legally to take care of peacetime disasters, or the sort of disasters that are characteristic of peacetime. And here is a situation where the people in a community themselves have to organize and be prepared to take care of an attack of a potential enemy on them. In other words, we have to get back to the basic philosophy of the American form of government, where the community itself has got to assume a great deal more responsibility than it has in the recent past. We can't expect George to do it. We can't expect Washington to do it. We've got to do it ourselves.
That's right. If we're at war, we're going to be expecting our military to be prosecuting the war someplace else. We don't want them at home taking care of us. I think, Dr. Ivey, you're exactly right. It's our job, and we've established that understanding and relationship with the military. We will assume our part. And if they happen to be here, or whatever facilities are available at the time, and of course their facilities and manpower changes from week to week and day to day. Here at Great Lakes, here at Fort Sheridan, the population of men change constantly. And I think it's proper that we set it up on the basis of helping ourselves. You're exactly right.
Well, now, what kind of mobilization is required on the part of the medical services, specifically Dr. Blair, to take care of a crisis of this sort, of all these non-fatal casualties to which you were referring a few minutes ago?
Well, I'd like to bring the matter of care down to the individual in his own home. The medical assistance he has been able to have in the past will not immediately be available. One of the 5 points in the program of the Chicago and Illinois State Medical Societies and Chicago Hospital Council and the Chicago Civil Defense Organization is the matter of self-help. Someone in every household should take the American National Red Cross First Aid Training course and become proficient in it in order that he might give assistance to himself, his immediate family, his neighbor, and if that area in which he lives escapes injury, he would therefore make himself available to the medical personnel in support of their efforts to alleviate a sickness and injury.
Well, are you suggesting that we wouldn't have enough doctors to go around if this thing really were to hit us?
No, I'm not saying that at all. We have enough doctors. We have our plan worked out so that we may even have a few to spare.
Yes, in that particular area, we plan to the dentists are cooperating with us, the osteopaths, the chiropodists, the veterinarians, everybody who has had any sort of training and taking care of injured people will be mobilized into this plan that we have here in Chicago, which includes the training and mobilization into teams and the indoctrination in drills of 102,000 Chicago citizens.
I should think that, Dr. Ivey, that panic would be one of your greatest problems if these bombs were to explode over us.
Yes, and that is point number one in our educational program. We have to educate the people of Chicago and every place to stay put in their house in the case of an A-bomb attack. There are a number of reasons for that. For example, the streets are going to be blocked by the police because the streets will have to be used by those who are going to save the lives of the 75% of the casualties as a result of the blast. Then furthermore, everybody knows, if they stop and think about it, if they rush out on the streets, they'll block the streets themselves. And furthermore, there will be some radioactive dust thrown up, and it'll take 15 or 20 minutes for that to settle. And if a person like that would get out in the street without proper protection, they would inhale a lethal dose of that. And furthermore, a mist may be thrown up, a radioactive mist, and they would inhale that. And around 30 to 45 minutes, after the blast, there occurs a radioactive rain, and they have to stay in for that reason. So that's the first principle. Now, the second principle is to pay no attention to rumors. As everybody knows who reads the newspapers, one of the tools of the communists is to create confusion, and they do this by rumors. For example, an attack of dysentery, or diarrhea, can be converted into plague or cholera by rumors. So we can't pay any attention to rumors.
The purpose of any enemy in delivering an attack of this sort against us, Doctor, would be to destroy or diminish our capacity and our will to resist. Now, if he can bring about that effect by panic and massive evacuation just by threatening us with an atomic attack, he can affect his purpose without ever having to drop the bomb on us in the first instance.
Yes.
Those are some of the very important subjects to be handled by our recently formed Public Information Committee. That committee is preparing to take these memorandums that we received from you, Dr. Ivey, and you, Dr. Blair, recently, and break them down into language that can be understood by all of the ages of people in school, in our schools, as well as parents, telling them what to do. And we hope to complete a really intensive plan of education so that people will do the proper things in the event we are attacked.
Well, this discussion suggests two questions. First, several references have been made here to bacterial warfare. Now, what does that have to do with an A-bomb attack, Dr. Ivey?
Well, we're always exposed to certain infectious diseases or contagious diseases after any sort of disaster, such as tetanus infection of the wounded cases, the coming in of typhoid, and a smallpox. Then, in order to do that, we have to immunize the people against tetanus and typhoid and smallpox, and that's one of our plans. But now, the bacteria can be used for sabotage. But I should like to tell everyone that the medical division of the Chicago Civil Defense has already made recommendations which are now being implemented to prevent sabotage on the bacterial front and other fronts.
Well, how would that be conducted? Through the water system, through food contamination, or what? If it were to be done.
Yes, those, and there are other ways against which we have set up agencies to prevent sabotage. For example, one is rats. We're going to have to eradicate the rats. They're not only a pest, a dangerous pest after an attack, but they're also a dangerous pest insofar as sabotage through disease is concerned. We've got to eradicate the rats and flies. But I want everyone to know that protection against sabotage in all the areas where sabotage might be used is now in process in the city of Chicago.
Well, now, Dr. Blair, precisely what ought a person to do in the event of an A-bomb attack? Let's say he's had a 30 or 40 minute alert. What advice would you give to him anyway?
I think he should seek cover in a sub-basement or the cellar of his own home, or behind as much earth or building material as he can, and stay undercover until the dust fallout has occurred and until the radioactive rain has fallen.
You think he ought to make any effort to get out of town if he's got a warning?
No, that's the last thing to try to do. Let him get, as Dr. Ivy said, and Dr. Blair said, let him get inside and stay inside. And keep close to a wall with his face to that wall, the strongest part of the structure that he may be in. And be prepared for flying glass and all sorts of things flying around at tremendous speed and with great damage.
We must emphasize that point about avoiding panic because there'll be a number of these alerts. There'll be dozens of alerts in the wartime.
Do you think you ought to provide shelters of one kind or another, Dreiske?
I think so. I think the building of individual shelters is inexpensive, it's simple, that is shelters for this type of bombing, and I think it, I know that it's part of our plan to recommend the construction of shelters by homes.
Well, gentlemen, this discussion has presented, I think, a pretty grim picture. But as one of you, I believe it was Dr. Ivy, put it earlier, we can hope for the best. But we better prepare for the worst.
Thank you, gentlemen. You've been listening to the Northwestern University Reviewing Stand discussion, What Should I Do in an A-Bomb Attack? Printed copies of these broadcasts, with a list of books and articles about the subject discussed, may be purchased for 10 cents in coin. A subscription may be obtained for $1 for the next 4 months, $2.50 for an entire year. Write to the Reviewing Stand, Northwestern University, Evanston, Illinois. Our guests today were Dr. Earl H. Blair, Victor C. Dreiske, Dr. Andrew C. Ivy, and Colonel Charles T. Tench. And now our moderator, James H. McBurney, will tell you about next week's program.
Next week, the Reviewing Stand presents a discussion of the peacetime uses of atomic energy. Our guest will be Farrington Daniels, former chairman of the Board of Governors for the Argonne National Laboratory and professor of chemistry at the University of Wisconsin. George Granger Brown, Director of Engineering with the Atomic Energy Commission. Sidney D. Kirkpatrick, Editorial Director of Chemical Engineering and Chemical Industries. And Paul E. Klopstig, Director of Research at the Northwestern University Technological Institute. We invite you to listen next week for Peacetime Uses and Problems of Atomic Energy.
The Northwestern University Reviewing Stand is broadcast coast to coast every week as a public service feature of Mutual. Your announcer, Frank Babcock. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.